So the final award tonight is, or this afternoon, is the INSAR Lifetime Achievement Award. And this is presented in 2015 to Laura Schreibman. And I think there will be nobody here who doesn't know Laura Schreibman's work and the absolutely crucial, tempted to say pivotal, but that's my jet lag making me pun, pivotal role in developing interventions for young people with autism. Laura is Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Psychology at UCSD, the Director of the Autism Intervention Research Program. She obtained her PhD in 1972 from UCLA, studying behavior analysis and intervention for children with autism. And she was one of the very first people to involve parents in intervention for their children. And it was her commitment to finding interventions that would work and were workable by parents that led to the development, her development, of pivotal response therapy. She's the author of several books, perhaps most notably The Science and Fiction of Autism in 2005. And this book, I think, stands testament to her very particular commitment to evidence. And talking to her colleagues, they tell me that she has shown throughout her career an absolute commitment to the data. And unlike some of us, not wedded to her own theory or practice, but caring only about what will work and what will make a difference for families. She's also selfless and generous in her tutorage and encouragement of her many students, who have kept in touch over decades and continue to count on her support and her wisdom and her advice. And she continues to advise students today. She is a wonderful role model and an embodiment, I think, of INSAR's aims and values to encourage the next generation. And she is a scientist who has really made an invaluable contribution both to autism research and to improving the lives of countless children with autism and their families. Laura, can I ask you to come on stage?
Hello, everybody. Welcome. Thank you for coming. I want to first, thank Frankie for that wonderful introduction. I want to thank the INSAR board and everybody else who was responsible for this this award. I am deeply, deeply honored, and wow, that's all I can say. I thought what I would do in my time here is to talk a little bit about how I got involved in the field, how things have changed since I've been in the field, what I think science has done, and talk about some of the priorities I see for the future. And where's my, here it is, okay. There we go. I want to talk about how I got started in this field, because I think students hopefully will be able to relate to this. It started one day in 1966. I was an undergraduate, I was a sophomore, in a psychology class at UCLA, and the course was called Pro-Seminar in the Exceptional Child. And it was taught by an interesting, rather quirky professor named Ivar Lovaas. And it became pretty clear pretty fast that the name of the course should have been Autism 1A, because that's really what it was about. And at the time, Lovaas was just really getting involved in his groundbreaking work utilizing operant discrimination methodology to teach skills to children with autism. I was fascinated as I sat there in the lecture hall day after day, and he talked about the work. I was fascinated by the work, and I was fascinated by the children with whom he worked. And then it happened. One day, he brought into the lecture hall three children that were participating in his lab. And that was it. Bam, done, finished, bam. I knew right then and there where my career was going to go. I was absolutely fascinated by these children. And to this day, which is almost 50 years later, I can remember the children's names, I can remember what they looked like, and most importantly, I can remember their behavior. I was absolutely hooked, not only in the children, but also in the behavior analytic approach to studying the children and to and working with them. I just thought that that was the best approach. So then after this course and other courses I took in developmental psychology, learning and motivation, experimental psychology, I found that my interests in the field were focused in two general areas. One was a basic understanding of the nature of autism, of the disorder, the characteristics, understanding the specifics, and also in the development of interventions, of treatments. And I felt that both of these areas were best addressed using both non-applied and applied behavior analysis. So accordingly, my first academic heroes in the field were Lovaas, Todd Risley, Mont Wolf, Don Baer, George Reynolds, Barbara Edsel, Judith LeBlanc, and other pioneers in the use of behavior analytic strategies to study children with autism. I was truly inspired by their work, their creative work, utilizing single subject methodology to carefully study environmental influences on behavior with almost a microscopic acumen. I just fell in love with the precision of this tightly controlled research approach, and I became a staunch behaviorist. Thus, my early work, my early non-applied work in language and attentional deficits utilized this methodology. Of course, I say non-applied in that the curriculum that was involved in the investigations may not have been a functional curriculum, but to me it was all applied because I felt that the results of this work would certainly inform treatment development. So that's how I kind of got started, and I had my BAM moment, and now, let's see here. This is a picture, I hope you can see it pretty well there. One of the things about being Lovaas' student is when he didn't want to do something at the last minute, he would send you there. So if you see this little shell-shocked person right there, you see that shell-shocked person is that way because of the incredible wattage of the academic community that she's standing with. Well, there you can see me, and here's Eric Schoppler, there's Leo Kanner, there's Stella Chess, there's Donald Cohen back here, and then there's me. Right there. And I mean, all I can think of is, you know, don't die, don't die, don't die. I was absolutely, you know, blown away. But again, it was the last minute, and Lovaas decided he didn't want to go, so I went. And it was quite an experience. I also want to say a little bit about where the field was when I started, for all you youngins in the audience who may not have a very good idea of where we were when I started. So what we were up against. Very few people knew what autism was. When I was an undergraduate, and even part of my graduate career at UCLA, and people would say, oh, what are you studying in school? I would say autism, or autistic children, as we used to say. And they would go, oh, are they good at drawing? You know, I would get that a lot. Few people knew what it was. Pediatricians didn't know what it was. We used to give lots of talks to pediatricians about what to look for, and they never had seen a kid with autism. They never expected to see a kid with autism. But again, remember, back then when we were talking about autism, we were talking about, you know, Kanner classic autism, much a narrower scope than what we refer to now when we talk about ASD. But very few people knew what it was. Also, parents were still being implicated in autism etiology. In a lot of parts of the country, the psychodynamic approach was still carrying a lot of weight, and parents were blamed, which of course caused a lot of anxiety and grief and pain to parents who certainly didn't deserve it. So that was something we had to fight. There were very few treatments available. That area of research was in its infancy. You know, Lovaas and some of the others were doing very, you know, very small, sort of restricted studies at that time, and it wasn't really available to people outside of university settings. So these parents really had very little in terms of where they could go for help. There were no mandated classroom education in most places. There was no federally mandated classroom education, and most of these kids fell right through the old loopholes of they didn't fit into any school program, so that there really was no classroom education for these kids, which was really redundant because we didn't know what to do with them in the classrooms anyway at that time. We didn't have the kinds of teaching strategies and the classroom strategies that we have now. And many of these children were placed outside the home before they reached adolescence. This was because there was lack of school programming for them, lack of treatment programs for them. The parents couldn't handle them. The kids got bigger and they got stronger, and especially if they had challenging behaviors, a lot of the parents couldn't handle them. And I remember going to homes where the rooms were stripped of furniture and they just had a mattress in the middle of the room because the child would, you know, destroy the furniture or whatever, and it was just horrific. But that was what we had at that time. So that's what we were up against. Another aspect of the field that I found particularly, uncomfortable, was that since autism was poorly understood, you got what you typically get when things are poorly understood. So you had a lot of unfounded theories and unsupported claims and arguments about the ownership of truth. You know, who is going to be right? And because, again, when you have a lack of understanding, it's like a vacuum that just sucks in all kinds of stuff, including these unfounded theories. And that certainly served to be a problem for the parents and anybody who was working with these kids. Perhaps more than any other field, autism has endured controversies and arguments, and it has been, in many respects, very passionate and very difficult. And I remember when I was, you know, early on in the field, you know, first we had the National Society for Autistic Children, which then became the Autism Society of America. And some of those early meetings, it got to where I didn't want to go because you had these different factions that were so passionate about their position on treatment or etiology or whatever it was, that the acrimony was just palpable. And I stopped going. I literally stopped going because I began to think they were going to be carrying weapons. It got to be that bad. And a colleague of mine, Andy Bondi, who I'm sure many of you recognize as the co-founder of PECS, he told me once about going to a meeting, a local meeting, and actual fisticuffs broke out. And this was in a church. So it could be pretty bad. And of course you have the rise of many, many unsupported and blatantly bogus treatments. I've been around long enough to see every off-the-wall, wacko, strange treatment being proposed. I mean, it goes on forever. And again, it's because of our lack of understanding, because we don't, you know, we didn't know, and when you don't know, people make stuff up. And there was a lot of making stuff up, and again, who's being victimized? The kids are being victimized, the families are being victimized, no one's getting ahead in this. So, our salvation has been sound science. I don't know why that looks so small, but anyway. Okay. And I'm preaching to the choir here, and I'm talking to a room full of scientists. But I am sure that our increased knowledge and our increased understanding of so many aspects of autism in terms of etiology and the course and progression of the disorder and treatment has helped reduce the arguing and the insistence on one's own specific truth. Autism has always been a complicated problem. It's a heterogeneous disorder. It's poorly understood. It's highly impactful and just plain difficult on so many levels, but we're just getting so much further ahead. So you have unsupported opinion has largely given way to empirically based knowledge. And that's really what we're here for, right? That's what we're here for. And very importantly, findings on factors related to etiology have greatly illuminated this important issue and helped equip the parents while focusing resources in more productive directions. And that, I think, has been one of the real gains and importance of science right there. We now have empirically supported treatments available. We have a variety of them. We're better at matching treatments to individual children. We're better at communicating the development of these treatments to places where they're going to do the most good, where they're going to reach children in the community, like schools and treatment centers and so on. So that has been a wonderful thing, and we can attribute that to findings of science. And the research community more and more is recognizing that autism is a very complicated problem and is being addressed that way by science. Science is looking at it not as a simple thing. Autism is not one thing. We know that now. There isn't an autism. There are autisms. There are many factors. We're really, since it's a behaviorally defined syndrome, there are obviously many, many factors that can be involved, and there may be very different etiologies and courses for different individuals. And the recognition of the need to develop individualized research and intervention protocols. I think this is very important, that there's no one-size-fits-all in terms of etiology or in terms of treatment. And again, that's just being refined by continued science. I'd like to talk a little bit about what makes me the most hopeful about the science of autism. What makes me most hopeful? And I am really hopeful now. I tend to be kind of a hopeful person anyway, and I was always kind of hopeful about the field of autism, but I'm just more hopeful now because of certain things. One is recognition that autism is an interdisciplinary problem requiring an interdisciplinary approach. There is no one discipline that's going to answer the many questions that autism poses. That's just not going to happen. And we're seeing more and more of the collaborative work in so many laboratories where the best and the brightest researchers from different disciplines are attacking the problems that autism poses. And I think that's great. You have different laboratories collaborating with each other. Within laboratories, you have individuals with different disciplines working together. You have funding agencies now that specifically are requiring interdisciplinary work for the funding for the projects, and I think that is just, you know, fantastic. And I'm most excited about the reduction of insularity of disciplines such that more common vocabularies and concepts makes our important work more accessible to a broader audience. And I'm giving an example of this. Many of you that have followed my work and work of my students and colleagues know that I've been involved in called naturalistic developmental behavioral interventions. And this is a term that we are using to describe several early intervention strategies that encompass principles of both behavioral and developmental psychology, so that you have a marriage of behavioral and developmental sciences, each of which has been so important in our understanding of the progression of the disorder, as well as normal childhood development and how those relate, and also to treatment. And I say it's a marriage because they are working together. And, you know, in the past, you know, you had sort of the behavioral people here, then you had the developmental people here, and, you know, they mostly were working sort of, you know, individually. And then, you know, there was a little dating and maybe hand-holding occasionally. But now we've got this marriage where they have worked together to identify common concepts that bridge both of these disciplines. And these NDBIs, or Naturalistic Developmental Behavioral Interventions, are an example of that. And, you know, when you earn the field and you kind of go and you do conferences and you do stuff, and things just sort of happen that you can see where the field is going. And I remember in 2010, several of us were invited to Manila at their first international conference on autism in the Philippines. And my colleague Sally Rogers and I were giving a workshop. And the way it was working was I'm giving the first half of the workshop and Sally was giving the second half of the workshop. So I get up there for the first half and I am talking about PRT, which is essentially came through the behavioral model as an intervention for kids with autism. And I'm talking about PRT and I'm doing my thing. And then it's Sally's turn and Sally gets up there. And Sally's talking about Early Start Denver model. Okay, so they've heard PRT, now they're getting ESDM. And I'm listening to her talk, and she's great and everything, and I'm thinking, wow, she and I are saying essentially the exact same thing. But we're using a different vocabulary. Our terminology isn't consistent. But the good news was we're saying the same thing, that coming from the developmental approach, like ESDM and the behavioral approach for pivotal response training, you could see where they were coming together. The sciences were coming together so that we could benefit from each other. We can understand, you know, the curriculum we should be teaching and how we can be teaching using behavioral strategies and so on. And it was just, I just sat there and I was just struck by it. And then afterward, I said, Sally, let me, and we were talking, and she and I kind of had a good laugh about it because essentially those people had, you know, the same workshop twice. They may not have realized it, but they had the same workshop twice. So that was kind of nice. That made me feel good. And again, it's just that reduction of the insularity when you get disciplines that are collaborating. Priorities for the future of autism research are, one, continue in the vein of interdisciplinary science to refine knowledge and help reduce the impact of autism via both biological and behavioral interventions. Because I think both of those are going to be important, and I was on a panel this morning, and I was sort of talking about how people are looking at, say, the biological effect of behavioral interventions. You know, and there's going to be more and more of this, I think, where the fields are going to be coming together. So that's great. Everybody's, you know, going to have their piece of the pie and be able to join. We must. This is another priority I have. We must pursue our work in the field as founded in science, not the marketplace. My former student and colleague, Dr. Margie Sharlop, who is here, surprised me by being here. She and I were talking about this and the fact that what's great about something like IMFAR is you have people that come whose priority is science and coming to conclusions based on science, not the marketplace. Autism is a big market, and as the rate of diagnosis increases, the market is getting bigger, and so you have a lot of people that want to come in and profit from it. And I think that's something that we have to be very, very wary of, that we get our science out there, and we support good science and don't support science that is aimed at selling a product. I think we all, you know, can think of examples where that has been the case, so that's a priority. Increase our intellectual flexibility. And what I mean by this is, in the light of the interdisciplinary work and interdisciplinary emphasis, we all need to be supportive of points of view that may differ from our own, and better yet, to incorporate this and these points to strengthen our own approach. I think that's how interdisciplinary science is going to work. Everybody has to give a little. Now, what's interesting is a major figure in this field said to me not long ago, oh, yeah, you know, I was talking about you to somebody, and I was talking about you, you know, that you're a former behaviorist and everything. And I'm thinking, huh? What? And I'm sure that he said that because of my work with the NDBIs and the interdisciplinary work and the, you know, with developmental. And, you know, it's just because I can embrace in developmental science and talk to developmental psychologists and cognitive psychologists and psycholinguists and so on, doesn't make me any less of a behaviorist. I am just as behavioral as I've always been. I just secretly translate everything they say to me into behaviorese. Works great. For me, this continues to be the best approach. To me, this approach makes the most sense. But I can certainly see the value of other approaches, and I can certainly see the value of including work from other approaches into my work. I mean, I'll always get a bit of a buzz out of putting together a perfectly controlled multiple baseline or simultaneous treatment to design. I probably always will. But, you know, so I am still a staunch behaviorist. I will die a staunch behaviorist. But behavioral is different now than it used to be. It's not as strictly determined, I guess. So anyway, I thought that was funny that I was a former behaviorist just because I could talk to a developmental psychologist. So anyway, we also need to focus on understanding and developing services for older individuals. This is a priority. I mean, I've always worked with kids, and my most recent work has been with really little kids, early intervention type kids. But, you know, more and more kids are getting diagnosed. More and more of these kids are aging out of the school system. What are we going to do with them? You know, there really needs, you know, it breaks my heart to hear a parent say, well, my kid's 5 years old, he's over the hill. You know, he's doomed. And it shouldn't be the case. So I really want to encourage people to work in this area with older individuals. And a lot of people are, but I'd like to see, you know, more of it because we're going to be needing it. Dissemination of research findings. Yeah, this is a tough one. You know, I'm sorry, we're not very good at this. How do we translate our findings to community settings where the potential of these findings will reach those who would most benefit? I mentioned this a little bit earlier, and I was on a panel this morning where there was some very good work in this area. And as a matter of fact, another one of my former students and colleague, Dr. Aubin Stamer, is a leader in this field of translational research, translating empirically based treatment strategies into the community, where it be, you know, to teachers or other community providers, because it doesn't do us any good to develop the world's best treatments only to have them stay in the laboratories at the university. If they don't get out there to the people that can use them or who are going to benefit, the kids, the families, and the providers, then we haven't accomplished anything. So I really think that a strong priority for us is to continue this translational work and get the findings from our important research that we worked so hard to come up with, get them out there to community areas. Okay, this is another one that said, how do we get the outside world to value our science? We're not so good at this either. When we're in a situation where the writings of a former Playboy bunny have more impact than all of the science that's been conducted on vaccines, then we're in serious trouble. You know, that should be a giant red flag. How is it that that happens? And after the latest huge study showing that vaccines did not cause autism, one of the researchers made a very good point. He says, you know, we could have 50 million studies and there'll still be people that don't believe us. Why don't they believe us? What's our problem? We need to do, and it's not just us. I think most scientific areas have this same problem. Is why can't we communicate better? We need to do so, I guess, in sort of non-threatening ways. What we need is, that should be an area of study. How do we disseminate in a way that is going to gain wider acceptance? Okay. I want to say some other thank yous now. I mean, the thank you part of my talk. I thanked INSAR and the board and everybody that was involved in my selection for this award. I want to thank my husband, Dennis, over there, who is probably almost as excited about me getting this award as I am. And my family, my stepdaughters and Denise is there, and we have friends here and former students, and it's just really fabulous. I want to thank everybody that has come. And I want to thank my graduate students that I've had over the years. I think that I couldn't have accomplished anything, really, without these wonderful students. You know, I mean, of course, I'm standing up here on the shoulders of so many others. And so many of them, you know, I've mentioned my mentors, some of the names earlier. But it's really the students. I'm especially indebted to them. Many of them are here in this room right now. And I just want to say what a pleasure it's been, what an honor it's been to work with all of you. I know that my job technically is to train and guide and supervise them, but in fact, I have learned so much from them over the years that it's really enriched me tremendously. I've learned the trick to this field is to find and pick really, really good and smart students and just point them in the right direction and get out of the way. Just hang on and get out of the way, because they're going to bring you forward. They have challenged me to think in new ways. They have had me pursue new areas of research and led me to so many exciting findings that I think the most rewarding part of this, of my career, has been working with such fabulous graduate students. And there they are. Each and every one has been a pleasure and a delight. I also want to thank the many children and parents who've participated in our studies over the years. These are families that have just been amazing. They have served to inspire me. They have served to encourage me along the way, and we would be nowhere without them. And I also want to end by saying that I want to acknowledge the many undergraduates that have come through my lab over the years. I've treasured the opportunity to be able to maybe inspire them and to perhaps for them to have that BAM experience that I had that set me off in such a hugely interesting and rewarding field. Thank you.